This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
My instinct was always to not let bullies prevail, even bullies who are bigger than you and stronger than you. The right thing to do is to fight back, and that's how I felt here. And so I suppose that perhaps served me well as I continued to find myself deeper into the center of the climate change battle.
Back in 1999, a team of scientists published a graphic depiction reconstructing northern hemisphere temperatures for the previous 1,000 years. The steep increase from the 1900s on inspired the scientific community to give this visual a clever nickname, the hockey stick graph. This week on Sea Change Radio, we sit down with Michael Mann, the lead researcher on that study that introduced a generation to the notion of climate change. He's widely published and has received a number of awards, the most recent being the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement in April of 2019. In our conversation, we talk about why academics should bust out of the ivory tower, examine the climate change denial movement, and explore how the adage, "the best defense is a strong offense," has served him well. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Michael Mann. He is a professor at Penn State University. He's a climate scientist and geophysicist. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
I wanted to talk to you about the science community and going on offense. We're talking about that right now a lot in the political realm because of the specter of impeachment looming over the entire governmental process. A lot of people are saying, would the Republicans be trying to impeach a Democratic president if the game was flipped? People say, go on offense politically. You've been able to kind of do that from an academic perspective, which is unusual. We talk about the ivory tower of academia, but you don't look at academia as something that's discrete from the rest of the world. You engage, and I appreciate that. Did you have some kind of epiphany where you said, you know what, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm going to go out and go on offense?
Yeah, thanks very much for the kind words. And indeed, 2 decades ago now, when we first published the now well-known hockey stick curve, and it became an icon in the climate change debate. And I was just a young postdoctoral researcher at the time, but I was suddenly thrust into the center of the raging sort of contentious debate over climate change and what to do about it. It's not, you know, the sort of place that a scientist expects to find him or herself. And it's, you know, suddenly you're operating in an environment where the rules of engagement are very different from those that pertain to science, where those who are criticizing you are not doing so based on, you know, legitimate, well-reasoned criticism, but to discredit you and to discredit your message. And as a result, I had to sort of learn, you know, these new rules of engagement, how to deal with bad face assaults on you and your integrity and on the science of climate change. So I was sort of forced out of the ivory tower. I didn't really choose to be at the center of the debate, but I did find myself there because of the nature of the hockey stick curve and the iconic significance it took on. Because of that, I was attacked by sort of the forces of denial, those looking to discredit the message by discrediting the messenger, in essence, the scientists and me in particular. And over time, I have come to embrace that role, that it wasn't the one I signed up for, it wasn't what I expected to be spending my life doing, but I can think of no greater privilege than being in a position to inform the public discourse, the conversation over what is arguably the greatest challenge we face, the challenge to avert catastrophic climate change.
And I assume it's also an honor to represent a lot of the scientists who may not feel as comfortable going on offense in terms of becoming the messenger for this message. Maybe you can share some of the flip side of that, where you feel like people want to marginalize your message, colleagues who want to marginalize your message, not just the right-wing machine.
Sure. There's always been sort of this conservative segment of the science community that that feels that somehow one diminishes oneself as a scientist by engaging in public outreach and communication. It's a phenomenon that certainly afflicted Carl Sagan, you know, one of the great science communicators of all time. Absolutely. He was a leading scientist, but he became a lead, sort of the face of science to the public. I grew up watching his series Cosmos. It instilled in me a curiosity about the world and many others as well, I'm sure. And because of that, he found himself under criticism by colleagues who felt that he shouldn't debase himself by communicating science to the public, that that's somehow beneath a scientist to venture outside of the academic or scientific realm. And to some extent, Sagan suffered the consequences. His science, the science that he did was of monumental significance and alone certainly was grounds for him being accepted into the National Academy of Sciences, but he was never accepted into the Academy. He was blackballed, in essence, by colleagues who perhaps felt a little jealous of the attention that he got, but partly out of this feeling that, well, if he's doing so much communication and outreach, he can't really be a great scientist too, can he? I think the fact that Carl Sagan sort of created room, space for other scientists to move into. And now in the environment that exists today, there's much more support, institutional support, support from fellow scientists for communicating the science. Because I think there's an awareness that if we don't do that, we leave a vacuum that will be filled by the voices of vested interest, those who have an axe to grind, who have ulterior motives and not the best interest of the public in mind. And so I would say that these days I find far more support than criticism for the role that I'm playing in science communication. I think we have a much more supportive environment now in the science community for those who want to step outside of the ivory tower.
I think Sagan's a great example. A lot of people only knew him through his appearances on TV, and he would be
Johnny Carson Show.
He'd be on Johnny Carson. He was a Saturday Night Live parody. Like he was part of our public consciousness, but he also took on some sacred cows in that he, as a scientist, felt an obligation to kind of respond to a lot of the religiosity that bothered him.
Right.
Throughout his career and throughout his lifetime, he wrote some amazing books about kind of popping holes in religiosity. There's one that I read called The Demon-Haunted World, and it's not something you would expect from a science professor. And I could see some of his colleagues maybe poo-pooing this venturing into additional realms. But isn't the whole idea of science is to... You want scientists who are intellectually curious and want to inspire others to think outside their boxes.
No, absolutely. And the full title of the book was The Demon-Haunted World, A Candle, Science as a Candle in the Dark, which is the title of one of the chapters in my book, The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, paying homage to Sagan. Of course, that was a wonderful book that is about, you know, sort of... the philosophy of science and how does one look at the world in a scientific way and why it is that science is this candle in the dark. It is a way forward, a way of furthering our understanding of the world and our, you know, and our place in it. And, you know, Sagan was willing to take on sacred cows. He was, careful not to diminish, religion. There's a place for that, but to clearly demark the boundaries between the role of faith and religion and the role of science. I was asked to recommend a book for the journal Nature. Two summers ago on their summer reading list, and they said it could be a new book or an old classic, and I chose to recommend The Demon-Haunted World because it really spoke with a foreboding of the very phenomenon that we are now witnessing today. And it's haunting when you read the book and you read some of the passages. Decades ago, Sagan was warning us about the world that we now live in, a world where people are disconnected from science and an understanding of technology, and as a result,
and facts
absolutely, and as a result, susceptible to demagogues who will step in with alternative facts and alternative view of the world that defies science, that rejects science. And of course, today, under the Trump administration, we live in that world. We have a president who rejects the teachings of science, who rejects the reality of human-caused climate change. Sagan warned us that this is the path that we were headed on decades ago, and now we find ourselves there.
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia, don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. We'll build an all-American amusement park there.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor Michael Mann. So speaking of the vacuum that Carl Sagan warned us about, paving the way for Trumpism in the era that we are in today. You've been keenly aware of the pushback on climate science over the last several decades. Maybe you can kind of give our listeners who aren't as aware of the American Heartland Institute and some of these other organizations just an overview of going to a conference or engaging quote-unquote scientists, your colleagues who are pretty much misinforming the public. That's kind of their modus operandi. It must be very troubling. Maybe you can kind of give us a brief summary before we go into understanding their motives more, though.
Sure. And, one uses here the term colleagues, loosely, because I don't consider individuals who have basically rejected science and instead have chosen to become mouthpieces for special interests who are seeking to attack and undermine public understanding and faith in science. I don't see them as colleagues. And unfortunately, there are a small number of individual scientists who did establish, serious credentials in science, but essentially sold their scientific souls to become talking heads, advocates, mouthpieces for industry special interests who use them and the imprimatur that they bring to attack their fellow scientists, to attack the scientific consensus, to cloud public understanding and further the agenda of special interests who find their profit motives in conflict with the findings of science.
And when you engage with a quote-unquote colleague or somebody who would consider themselves a scientist, and I can see it being ugly in a public forum, but maybe you can kind of give us a peek behind the curtain.
Sure. And, and it is something you encounter, the taxi driver, the person, on the train, what have you. As a climate scientist, sometimes you find yourself engaged in casual conversation that does end up leading into a discussion of climate change. And it's always a somewhat uncomfortable place to find yourself.
Especially when you're one of the leading experts in the field. But you have to be respectful, obviously, in order to win that person over, though, right?
Absolutely. You have to determine where they're coming from. You have to sort of meet them where they are. And sometimes you can tell, it's immediately obvious that the person is simply misinformed. They are a victim of the misinformation campaign, and they should be treated in that manner. They're not the enemy. They're the victim. And it's your sort of job in that situation to try to aid them, to provide them not just with real information, but sources, where they can go to become more informed and sort of help them down that path. Now, sometimes you're dealing with the professionals, people who know well, who understand the science and have chosen to reject it for ideological reasons, for profit motives. In that case, you're operating with somebody who is not engaged in good faith, and it would be a mistake to assume that they are. You're probably not going to win them over with facts and information because, again, they're coming at this from an entirely ideological or profit-driven direction.
They have allies other than facts.
Absolutely. They're being paid by fossil fuel interests to become, you know, agents of misinformation and disinformation. And in that case, you're not going to win them over, but the danger is others caught in the crossfire. If you look at the latest polling, it's less than 10% of the American public is what we might call a dismissive, somebody who proactively, you know, goes out there and is trying to communicate misinformation to the public. It's a small sliver of the population, but they have an impact that is out of proportion with their numbers because of the megaphone that exists in the form of the conservative media, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, Breitbart News, etc. They're able to sort of create this echo chamber of misinformation and disinformation. And we need to fight that because innocent victims are caught in the crossfire, have been misled into thinking that there is a scientific debate about the basics when there isn't.
And because of that sliver being very vociferous and not necessarily well-grounded in rationality, do you ever fear for your safety? Maybe you can kind of talk about some of the scarier blowback that you get for speaking out about your area of expertise, which should not be controversial in a rational world.
Well, thanks. Yeah, you know, I have found myself subject to all sorts of threats against my, you know, my own safety, thinly veiled threats against my family. I had an envelope that was sent to me with a white powder in it that had to be investigated by the FBI out of the fear that I and my colleagues might have been exposed to, you know, anthrax.
But it was just a hoax.
It was a hoax, absolutely. But
Scary hoax, I'm sure.
Well, right. And the person still accomplished the task, which was to intimidate and to try to instill fear, right? Because what they want you to do is to back off. They want you to stop what you're doing. And so I learned long ago that the worst thing you could possibly do would be to give in to those tactics. And so if anything, the attacks against me, including the threats against me, if anything, have emboldened me in my effort to get out there and to communicate the science and its implications to the public. If they're coming at me, If they're working so hard to intimidate me, to threaten me, to scare me, there must be something important about this message I'm trying to deliver. That's sort of the philosophy that I suppose governs the way I view the attacks and the intimidation efforts against me and other scientists.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and that piano playing you just heard was a little impromptu performance I was treated to a few moments ago by none other than this week's guest, Dr. Michael Mann, a climate science professor from Penn State University. So, Mike, I want to take a step back to the beginnings of your education. When you were studying the environment and science, what kind of light bulb moment did you have? Climate science was actually in its infancy in a lot of ways. There wasn't a clear path for a burgeoning college grad to delve into. Why don't you kind of walk us through your thought process as a 20-something-year-old man?
Yeah, I was actually, in 89, I had just graduated from UC Berkeley and had headed off to graduate school at Yale University just months before the Loma Prieta earthquake struck. And I was a physics major as an undergraduate, and I went off to graduate school at Yale University to study physics. I had studied applied math and physics as an undergraduate, had sort of plan to go into the field of theoretical physics. And about midway through my PhD, I had passed all my exams. I was ready to commit to a research project, and I decided that my heart wasn't in it. This isn't what I wanted to be spending the rest of my life doing. And so I opened up the catalog, the science catalog at Yale, to see what else was going on that might, you know, excite me, that might motivate me. And I saw that there was a professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics just down the hill from the physics building that was using math and physics to model and understand Earth's climate. And that struck me as fascinating. And I went off, talked with him. The rest is history. I decided to do my PhD instead in that department, working with my advisor, Barry Saltzman, on modeling Earth's climate system. But at the time, it was nothing other than a fascinating physics problem that did have some real-world implications. But, you know, I wasn't a climate change true believer. I wasn't driven by a policy agenda. I was driven by an interest in working on the fundamental science of a really interesting problem. And my work ultimately led me into the very center of the contentious policy debate because of the hockey stick curve, when we published this curve that demonstrates how dramatic recent warming is, and it became an icon in the climate change debate. Whether I liked it or not, I was now at the center of that debate. I was at the center of efforts by special interests looking to discredit me. And I had to decide, you know, whether I was going to withdraw, retreat from the battle into my laboratory and continue just to do the science that I love doing, or whether I was going to fight back. And I suppose something about my constitution, my personality, intrinsic to my personality, my instinct was to fight back. My instinct was always to not let bullies prevail, even bullies who are bigger than you and stronger than you. The right thing to do is to fight back. And that's how I felt here. And so I suppose that perhaps served me well as I continued to find myself deeper into the center of the climate change battle.
Speaking of fighting back, a lot of people who are less optimistic than you will approach something like climate change and say, well, we're already past the point of no return and may as well just get the biggest gas-guzzling car and turn up the AC because we're all going to die anyway. You look at things in a much through a much more optimistic lens, I believe. Here at Sea Change Radio, we try to look at solutions to some of these seemingly intractable problems. Maybe you can give us a glimpse into your thinking of fighting back, not just from the merchants of misinformation, but the actual Sisyphean task in front of us and trying to reverse the damage that our species has wrought on the planet. Where do you see some of the best solutions that are realistic?
Yeah, and you know, the best defense is good offense. And I long ago decided that by being out there and promoting the real conversation to be had about what we do about this problem, not whether it exists, but what we can do to tackle the problem, that's the best way to fight back against the agenda of denial and delay, is to use the opportunity that I had in the limelight, in the center of this arena, to try to promote a meaningful conversation about climate change. And the message that I carry with me today, it's almost a mantra of mine, is urgency and agency. So there is great urgency to acting now. We are already seeing the detrimental impacts of climate change, the dangerous impacts of climate change. And yet there is still time to avert the worst impacts of climate change. And there is agency in what we do. We still have a role. It's still up to us as to what our future looks like. Of course, there are lots of things that we can do in our everyday lives to decrease our own carbon footprint. And, you know, and there's a lot of discussion about that lately. But I think that we have to understand that the real solution is larger than that. It's not about individual action. It's about collective action and holding our policymakers accountable to us, rather than the special interests who often fund their campaigns, the fossil fuel interests who would like them to pursue an agenda of denial and delay. There needs to be a penalty. There needs to be a cost for politicians who choose to further the agenda of polluting interests rather than the people they're supposed to represent. And so it does collide with sort of the world of denial and delay and disinformation, because it has infected our politics. And ultimately, we need a shift in our politics if we're going to tackle this problem. The good news is there's some evidence that that's starting to happen. We're even seeing increasingly Republicans in Congress saying, you know, we can't continue to deny this problem. The public understands there's a problem. The impacts are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in real time. Let's come to the table with our sort of our views about how to tackle the problem. And that's a worthy debate. And, that, you know, there is a worthy debate to be had about what policies we pursue to address climate change. So I think we're turning the corner there, in part because of the shift in our politics. We've now got a House of Representatives that is run by Democrats who, you know, not only accept the science, want to do something about it. And there's this international youth movement that's changing the entire conversation. Kids literally out there marching in the streets demanding that the adults of the world act now before we, you know, destroy the planet for them and future generations. And that is having a real impact on the conversation. I think we're near a cultural tipping point of climate action, but we're not going to get there without everybody continuing to push forward. And so I'm trying to be part of that collective effort to make sure that we do move forward and we do tackle this problem before it's too late.
You're receiving the Tyler Prize today for your outstanding contribution to the science community. I bet when you were opening up that curriculum description and seeing the climate class that seemed intriguing, I'm assuming you did not know that it was going to overlap with so many other realms of our world today.
No, not at all. I'm humbled to receive this award. So many who've come before me who are literally heroes of mine, of the role that they've played in, again, in the larger public conversation about environmental sustainability, which is a sort of a multi-varied problem, but climate change is one aspect of that. It is literally the last thing that I, you know, thought I was going to be doing with my life. When I double majored in applied math and physics at UC Berkeley and went off to Yale to study theoretical physics, I didn't feel like I was on a path that would lead me to the center of arguably the most contentious political debate we've ever had. But having found myself in a position to influence this conversation, I've decided that there's nothing more important I could be doing with my life. I'm honored to receive the Tyler Prize, greatly honored, and the other accolades that, you know, that have come my way. But that's not what's motivated me. What's motivated me is to use the position that I'm now in to make sure that we don't fundamentally degrade this planet for my daughter, for our children, for our grandchildren. There's still time to make sure that that's our legacy. And I see my role as trying to ensure that that is not our legacy.
Dr. Michael Mann is a professor at Penn State University. Mike, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Brass Construction and Randy Newman. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.